This is Jim Inkster coming today on the show. We are slated to hear from Frank Campbell, the former president of the American Association of Suicidology. He is an expert on suicide and has spent most of his career right here in Baton Rouge, where he is the former executive director of the Crisis Intervention Center. Frank Campbell on Robin Williams, Scott Rogers, and much more. Also, John Ed Bradley, the celebrated writer from Louisiana State University, the pride of Opelousas, and he's back with another book, one of his best, Call Me By My Name. And one of his pieces in Sports Illustrated was selected as one of the top 60 stories in the 60-year history of that publication. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. And outside the area, please call 877-217-5757, inkstershow@wrkf.org online, and you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Our leadoff guest is Frank Campbell. He is an expert on the sensitive issue of suicide, and for many years he was based here in Baton Rouge, executive director of the Crisis Intervention Center, and he's the former president of the American Association of Suicidology. And this topic, which is unfortunately always with us, came to the forefront a few weeks ago with the death of Robin Williams by his own hand. And of course, in the last few days, this community has been riveted by the death of Scott Rogers, which has been reported by authorities as a attempted murder and suicide. Good morning, Frank Campbell.
Good morning, Jim.
Well, first of all, we've discussed this before, but why are people so reluctant to talk about one of the most prevalent things in our society, people taking their own lives?
Well, I think there's been a fear of contagion for a long time, and certainly the media guidelines have helped shape the way reporting on suicide can avoid contagion. But the stigma attached to this cause of death goes back thousands of years. And unfortunately, if not talking about it was working, we wouldn't see the increased numbers in suicides and rates of suicide in our country.
Well, Robin Williams was a celebrated star, wealthy, fabulously famous, a beautiful wife who apparently was in love with him, and yet he took his life and battled demons for many, many years when he was at the height of his powers. How does this happen?
Well, I do think that one of the common misunderstandings is that people that die by suicide, first of all, may or may not have money, or they may not be well-loved, or they may not have families that care about them, and that's not been the experience I've seen over the years. People that are loved, people with income, people with many things in their basket that would indicate moving toward life, still take death as a choice. And his suicide, unfortunately, leaves us trying to figure out why. And why is quite a distraction, because every suicide is self-defined, and that's the challenge, you see, to look at large numbers and still come up with variables that match up over a broad group. Unfortunately, Robin Williams very much fits the stereotype of male suicides, especially in his age range.
And why is that?
Well, one thing you might imagine is that people who are battling demons, as you suggested, and I absolutely agree with that caricature, are often isolated. Celebrities, wealthy individuals, people with power, often wonder, do people really care for me, or is it my money or power or stardom that attracts them to me? So there may be great self-doubt, some sense of perceived burdensomeness, thwarted belongingness, and then eventually capability to die by suicide that Thomas Joyner out of Florida has put forth as a current theory on suicide. And that is probably more helpful for us, looking at one person at a time rather than speculating about all the things that should be protective factors.
Well, suicide in the United States is prevalent, but it's 33rd as a country we are in the world in the proportion of people who take their lives. Still, the 12th leading cause of death in the United States. And
well, the 2011 data, which is the most current I have available to me, unfortunately, the CDC is not able to generate a total picture of U.S. area until several years out. Shows suicide has remained number 10 cause of death in our country based on the CDC rankings. And certainly, as far as preventable cause of death, it's considered the number 2 cause of death that's most preventable in the world. So even though our ranking may appear among those countries that report suicide to be somewhere in the middle, based on male or female, you can separate gender, you still would recognize that what we have in the United States is where suicidology began. We still are fighting a battle that's gaining on us rather than us winning.
So you say the CDC has it as the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S. And for young people ages to 15 to 24, the suicide rate is 3rd as far as the cause of death. So,
correct.
Unfortunately, this is something that quite often does happen to young people.
Absolutely. When you look at 10 to 14-year-olds, it's going to be ranked 3rd. 15 to 24-year-olds, 2nd, and 25 to 34-year-olds, 2nd. So from 10 to 34, it's either 2nd or 3rd cause of death in the country. And what many parents who lose a child in this age range say, as you know, I knew that the danger for my child was sexually transmitted diseases. I knew about drug addiction and alcohol as a concern. But why didn't I know suicide was on their radar at such a high level? And all the way out to 54, it's either the 4th or 5th cause of death. So it's really in the top 5 for 10 to 54-year-olds, and my guess is most of us would be surprised to know that.
And more men do it than women.
Yeah, the ratio is that men die about 4 times more often than women by suicide, and women attempt about 3 times more often than men.
So
you have this paradoxical relationship with suicidal behavior that, again, thwarts our ability to isolate on who's at risk. The best thing we can do, Jim, is if we're concerned about a person, not allow the 9 living clues that they might present simultaneously one dying clue to distract us. We've got to be able to go at that dying clue, that dying statement, and here it is, an invitation to say, that bothers me when you say you won't be needing this in the future. Are you having thoughts of suicide? To be able to ask that question as though we're asking someone to pass the salt or pepper, that kind of natural flow in a conversation would give signal to the person who's having thoughts of suicide that, yes, they are having these thoughts, because that happens about 5% in our population. We're talking about 16 million people every year they experience thoughts of suicide, and about 40,000 who will die by suicide versus 16,000 who will die by homicide. Yeah. You can see it's a much bigger issue than we would ever have a sense of.
40,000 by suicide in the U.S. each year, 16,000 by homicide.
Yeah, the 2011 data is the most current. And, of course, this is the most underreported cause of death because it could go disguised as accidental, undetermined, overdose, et cetera. So we know that it's underreported. But there will be the estimate to the CDC was that there were 39,518 suicides in 2011, and certainly during that same time, there were a little over 16,200 homicides that were identified. And some of those homicides could have been suicides, as you can appreciate. We have this inability in 5 causes of death to always rule precisely, but I think coroners work really hard to make sure there's forensic evidence to call suicide.
So about 2.5 times the number of homicides are the number of
suicides.
Okay.
So what is problematic for suicidologists is to try and help the general public understand how challenging it is to land on just one data point. Because if you do, it sets you up to not really understand that the opposite might also be true. For example, we often read, and it is reported, that many people who die by suicide are experiencing some form of clinical or situational depression, and yet 90% of people with clinical depression will never die by suicide. So we've got this kind of opposite that's also true, and sometimes that renders us somewhat paralyzed. So like, well, how do we know? Well, we know by asking. Same way we'd ask someone if you don't feel well, because we can look at them and see they look like they have a fever, they look like they're uncomfortable. We should use that same skill set to say, I'm worried about you, or are you having thoughts of suicide? And then get them the help they need and don't leave them alone.
877-217-5757, wherever you are, for Dr. Frank Campbell, former president of the American Association of Suicidology. And if you're dialing locally, 297-5633. Charles on North Foster. Good morning, Charles.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Dr. Campbell. Two quick questions. The first one, you guys mentioned battling demons, but it doesn't seem anyone is offering any solutions beyond the physical. I mean, if we're going to be battling demons, this is a spiritual issue. The other question is, why isn't mental illness, which I assume we agree that suicide is, treated like any other illness, whereas for life insurance, if someone commits suicide, it's just like they, you know, they were fine and just decided to go home early. I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Well, certainly Charles points to some of the confusion in language. I think most of us, when we talk about battling an internal demon, it may be considered a spiritual issue. I don't consider mental illness to be a spiritual illness or an illness in which someone is lacking a spiritual connection. In fact, I think people that battle other physical illnesses would also refer to those as demons in that they are torturing them. So it's more of a symbolic reference and not intended to, for a religious context. However, religion has never been a protective feature in suicide as far as the data shows. The data suggests that people with strong faith still die by suicide, as reported in the Bible and other locations of all major denominations. What we do know, though, is that prayer is often a resource for people in crisis. And I would rather focus on the fact that suicide is a cause of death, and that's why suicide shows up. Now, the issue about insurance, most insurance clauses have a no-suicide clause for the first couple of years. After that, suicide is not a relevant reason not to deny a claim. But that's because researchers found many years ago that if a person bought insurance with the intent of suicide, that even a year out, they would not die by suicide. And it was enough of a risk that insurance companies were willing to double that time span, go to 2 years. And my experience is that in insurance claims, when a person dies by suicide within that time frame, most insurance companies refund all of the payments. They really are not, and this is the history of their organizations, they're not interested in that industry and making money off people that are planning to die by suicide.
Veronica, but they're certainly
confusing.
Veronica in Denham Springs, you're on with Dr. Campbell. Hi, Veronica.
Hi. Do you think a huge part of the problem is our stigma in this country with mental illness and that we keep it hidden in the dark? People are afraid of talking about it. For instance, there are words with racial epithets that are, the N-word is no longer allowed. Words with gay slurs aren't allowed. But people make fun of bipolar people, people with schizophrenia on a regular basis. Could that be part of the problem? Thanks.
Well, thank you for your call, Veronica, and I absolutely would agree. One of my hopes out of a high-profile suicide like Robin Williams is that more and more we will get away from what were the common features in his death and instead talk about what as a society we could have done to help him. People battle tremendous affective disorders, depression, mental illness, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and others in our world. And what we need to be doing is learning more about these illnesses rather than putting them in some kind of a bin.
297-5633, your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. We shall return with Dr. Frank Campbell and also hear from the celebrated writer John Ed Bradley after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A bit more time with Dr. Frank Campbell, former head of the American Association of Suicidology, and he is here to talk with us about a sensitive topic, and it was brought into the forefront again less than 3 weeks ago when Robin Williams took his life. In the New York Times story, it says, with his suicide at age 63, Mr. Williams forever shut the window on a complicated soul that was rarely visible through the cracks of an astonishingly intact show business career, given his well-publicized troubles with depression, addiction, alcoholism, and a significant heart surgery in 2009. Mr. Williams should have had a resume filled with mysterious gaps. Instead, he worked nonstop. Is that rare, or is there usually a telltale sign or two or three, Dr. Campbell, when somebody is afflicted with depression and other demons?
Well, certainly one of the consistencies is that he's been through crisis after crisis in his life, and his ability to cope with a crisis may have resulted in a high work ethic. This is commonly thought of with comedian and artistic individuals, that their art, their form of expression, is one of the places where they feel the most alive. But what really frustrates me, and I hope will change, is the opportunity when someone is in a recovery program to also get treatment and recover and growth from thoughts of suicide, because we see suicide so highly represented in individuals battling relapse. And following a relapse, sometimes that's when we find the body and we experience the loss to suicide. We have a suicide about every 13 minutes in the United States every day, and it would be wrong to focus on just one death. But what is common, even though each suicide is unique, not everything about suicide is unique, and one of the things that tends not to be unique is the ability to grow, use recovery and growth models to develop resources in the future to protect against suicide. We tend to focus on protecting against symptoms of depression like alcoholism or drug addiction. And it would be nice if we could also include protecting against suicide. I'm currently involved in some development work in that area, and we're field testing and clinical training. But that will only still touch a small number of people who seek clinical treatment. Most people talk to a family member or a friend or a coworker. And we've got to make sure everyone's trained on the river of suicide to be lifeguards and provide suicide first aid.
Are guns most often used?
They are. There's been a decline in gun suicide in the last few data points that we have. Women have returned to poisoning as a more conventional method, just slightly above firearms. But firearms continue to be located there. Now, I want to make it clear, this is not an anti-firearm statement. I want us to understand that it's about reversibility of method. The more reversible the method is, the more likely a person might seek help before they die. And so firearms have a low reversibility. And so requiring or suggesting to people to do gun restriction or method restriction if they're concerned about a family member has resulted in fewer firearm suicides would be my inference on that. But all types of death occur when it comes to suicide. All methods may be used. Poisoning tends to be the largest method around the world because it's so available. And less reversible methods are my bigger concern.
6 days ago in this community, the popular television host, Scott Rogers, who had demons that we were unaware of, was, according to reports, he was killed by a friend who then took the gun and tried to kill himself. Now, another alleged victim of Scott Rogers came forward and said that that Scott had offered the idea of killing himself and the other gentleman killing himself simultaneously. How often these suicides come in cases where somebody else is involved?
Well, the homicide-suicide continues to be an issue, and co-death by suicide with senior citizens where perhaps one is in a health care crisis, the other has been the caregiver, and they choose to, the caregiver takes and takes the life of the person who's having the health issues and then takes their own life. But the reality is these are the most rare types of suicides, even reactionary suicides where a loved one might be killed by another one accidentally and then they turn a weapon on themselves, like in a hunting accident or something. These represent probably fewer than 1% of all causes of death by suicide. So the disadvantage of these stories is it distracts us from the day-to-day reality that if we ask somebody, they haven't thought of suicide, we could probably help them right then rather than get in this place where we have some kind of leveraging behavior where someone takes someone else's life and then attempts their own because they can't live without that object of affection or they can't stand going forward in life without that person or the reality of what they've done by committing homicide. People die by suicide every day for much more treatable reasons. This is a self-defined crisis, but it is not necessarily helpful to think of suicide as a permanent solution to a temporary problem, which is what Bill Donahue coined years ago. You lose somebody in your life, that's not a temporary problem. And the integration of that death into your life may be so overwhelming. That's why we find crisis lines to be so effective, Jim. And, you know, there in Baton Rouge, you have 924-3900, the phone, the 24-hour resource, the Baton Rouge Crisis Intervention Center since 1970. Has been answering these calls and making a very big impact on reducing suicide when compared to other parishes in the state.
924-3900.
That's Campbell. A local number. Yeah, there's an 800-273-TALK or 8255 is the national line, and technology will reroute that call to your nearest crisis center.
And you were there from day one, weren't you?
Well, no, actually, I came in 86 and stayed on in some form or another until about 2009 when we closed the foundation, which was a different resource in the center. So I was certainly connected to the center for many years, and the most valuable training I received, it's still a outstanding lighthouse in this country for how to learn this field of suicidology.
Thank you, Dr. Campbell. Good to talk with you.
Thank you, Jim, and thank you, listeners, for participating in today's call.
Thank you, sir. And now in studio, on a happier note, is John Ed Bradley, the pride of Opelousas and Louisiana State University and one of the best writers in the world today. He's back with another top-flight novel, Call Me By My Name, and we will get to that book in short order, but... John Ed's backstory is one of the great ones of all time. Went to school at LSU, was an all-conference center 35 years ago. It's hard to believe it's been that long.
Unreal. I can't believe it. It's horrible.
35 years ago this month, one of the searing moments in your life occurred when the University of Southern California came to town.
Yeah, I still dream about it. I'll never get over that one. Never quite recovered from it. It was a heck of a night in Tiger Stadium. And I think everybody who was there that night remembers it and will always remember it. But we were probably at our finest, even though we lost. I still still upset that we lost that one. But, yeah, it was quite a night. It was a long time ago. It feels like – starting to feel like ancient history. You know, I often think the guys who are playing there now, playing at LSU now, weren't even, you know, they weren't around.
No.
They were a long time from coming. But that was a heck of a night.
17-12, USC won and did so in the closing seconds. And LSU almost rallied at the end to win. Steve Ensminger was throwing in the end zone.
He was.
You were
blocking. I see him now, you know, on television. I'll see him on the sideline next to Les Miles. And it's quite a thing to see Steve as a coach. He was... He was tall, strapping, good-looking guy, could throw the ball a mile. He was a heck of a player. David Woodley, you know, was there at the same time. And good guys, good players. And it's nice to see Steve still associated with the program.
And you were their center.
I was a center.
Yeah. Well, Charlie McClendon, your coach, he was talking about that game literally on his deathbed.
He was. I went to see him. I guess it was 2001 when he died, and I had put off seeing him. I just didn't want to face it all, and I went there and to his house, and it was just 2 days before he died, and we're talking about USC again, and he still was still vivid in his mind. It was that was quite a thing for me, and it inspired. It inspired me personally, and it inspired me to write a story for Sports Illustrated about it. I that came months later. It was called The Best Years of His Life. And, that story became It Never Rains in Tiger Stadium, which was published about 7 years ago now. But if not for that moment with Coach Mack, that book never would have happened, and it was quite a thing to see him again that late in the game. I really love Coach Mack. Mm-hmm. Great, great guy.
That story was recently selected as one of the top 60 stories in the history of Sports Illustrated, celebrating its 60th anniversary.
It was. It was amazing.
You're not big into accolades, but that's a distinct honor.
Well, it was a surprise, and it was a great honor. It was a little story that I found very difficult to write. I wrote it quickly, but I didn't think it would have it would have such an audience and that it would impact anybody. In fact, I tried to get it back. I didn't want the magazine to publish it. After I sent it in, I called my editor and said, I'll do anything. Can I have it back?
And what, it was too personal?
I thought it was too personal. I thought I was embarrassing myself. I thought I'd really put myself out there. I had written a lot of stories for the magazine, a lot of big stories, but they were all about other people. It was the first person story I had done for the magazine. And I really did it. I was hoping to get rid of it. I thought I was a big fan of Hemingway, and he said, if you write it, you get rid of it. And so I thought if I wrote that story, it would be, I could sort of purge it from my head. Well, you don't purge Tiger Stadium and Charlie McClendon and that experience. But the piece, they ran it, and it was a big piece. It did a lot for me, I guess. The lady who does the letters to the editor told me that it was by far the most, she'd received the most letters over that story, that year. And it's been published probably in 10 or 12 different anthologies. It's been published all mm-hmm. all over the place and all over the world. I just never saw that coming. I thought other pieces I had done were more significant, mm-hmm. but people liked mm-hmm. it.
In that time in your life, 1979 is when you began getting things published.
Yes, it was.
In fact, the USC week, you wrote a diary.
I did. Yeah, I kept a diary, and I wasn't a diarist. I didn't keep a journal. The Morning Advocate, as it was called then, asked me to keep a diary, and I did, and they published it. And that was the first big thing I'd ever had published. I published in Man Shack. Do you remember Man Shack?
I do.
Yeah, I published there, and it was the literary journal published by students at LSU in the English department. But it was the first big story for me, and that was USC, mm-hmm.
And later that year, Alabama, which actually did win the national title that year, USC was second.
That's
and,
right.
Alabama went undefeated, and so did USC, by the way. But Alabama beat LSU 3-0 in the rain at Tiger Stadium,
yes,
despite the fact that it never rains.
Another loss.
But one of the things I recall, and I don't know if you've written about this, you probably have, and in fact, I think you have, but you talked about how at one point during the game you actually rolled over on the sidelines intentionally so you could touch Bear Bryant?
Well, I don't think I touched him, but I rolled over right at his feet. And, you know, you get up and you're looking at Bear Bryant. It's quite a thing. But the rain was coming down. And the thing I remember about that game was that how we couldn't get any offense going. I mean, we just could not do anything, mainly because of because of them. But the field was very wet. I remember I broke my ring finger. And it was so cold, the ground was so cold and wet that it sort of anesthetized the pain. You know, it was a tough night, tough loss. It was one of those years we played hard. We were kind of a classic MAC team. You know, we were we played really hard, and we didn't pull it out. You know.
Mm-hmm. And you were the starting center and an all-conference center that year, and I think you weighed about 234. Is that right?
You know, that it's hard to – quarterbacks are bigger now. I think I weighed 234 in the spring, and by the time the season started, I was, 248, 250. I had put on some weight. But I can tell you, after a game, I probably weighed 225. I lost so much weight from sweating. I was a skinny guy. I was tall, and I look at the guys now, and they're massive. You know, we really didn't have any guys like that. We were more, I think we were probably a little faster, leaner. They were after other things back then. There just weren't that many huge guys.
Healthier, of course.
Probably. And our blocking schemes were different. I mean, now there's a lot of, mano a mano stuff going on. I think there was a lot of daring do in what we did. It had a lot to do with quickness and, I didn't feel small. I never felt like I was undersized. I was light, but we went in every game you always think you're going to win. And I always thought I would prevail. I'd do well. Didn't always happen, but we were always game.
I recall you saying that you didn't have any fat guys on the team. There's some fat guys on the team now.
Well, they're big guys, and they run really well. They're massive. They're powerful guys. I played against some guys. I think I played against one guy who was in the 290s, and some guys in the 280s and 270s. And, it was tough to stand up against them. Certain plays, it was tough to compete with them. But, we managed. And, they're a lot fatter than we were. Yeah. They are.
Yeah. Well, John Ed Bradley has since become one of the most heralded writers in this land. And he's still got a lot of great years left. His latest work is Call Me By My Name. And we'll talk about his literary pursuits when we return. 297-5633, your number, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Back in 90 seconds with the pride of Opelousas, John Ed Bradley. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. John Ed Bradley, the former LSU football stalwart, all-conference in 79, as a center for Charlie McClendon and Coach Mack's final year. And the 35 years since, John Ed has become one of the more renowned writers in our country. And he and I went to school together. We're the same age. I'm a few months older, but both born in 1958, the year of LSU's last perfect season. And when we were in J school together, we both, of course, wanted to have careers. I think I was on the road. I knew what I wanted. I wanted to be in radio. But John Ed, you had a few twists and turns, but you got a job fairly early in your first journalistic job. Mine was working for Brother Jimmy Swaggart. Yours was working for
the Washington Post. Yeah. Well, I didn't want to be a journalist. I wanted to be a novelist. I think that's one way we were different. We had similar aspirations, but I knew even when I was at LSU that I wanted to be a novelist and write books. And I was very reluctant to get into journalism, but it was the only thing I could get. And I started the Washington Post, and I started writing for them in 1982. And they hired me as a staff writer pretty quickly, and I was there until maybe 87, I think, is when I left. And I left to write for magazines and to write books. My first novel was published in 88. It was called Tupelo Nights. Mm-hmm. But that's how things started for me. And I continue to work as a journalist. It was 93 when I started with Sports Illustrated, so it's been 21 years. But I've, done a lot of magazine writing.
Well, nobody profiles people better than you, and that includes sports people and
thank
others.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I recall, what was it? It was for Esquire, for Dennis Quaid. That was a cover story.
Cover story. You know, I work incredibly hard at those stories. You never know it to look at one of those stories, what goes into putting it together, but I work hard as a reporter, getting information, interviewing people. That takes forever. And then I tape everything. I tape record all these interviews, and then I break them down. I transcribe them, and then I write the story. And sometimes magazines have a tight schedule, and they want it quickly. So, there's a quick turnaround on these pieces. It requires a lot of work, but I just try to tell stories that I think might be entertaining, and sort of put it in story form. I like the new journalism. I remember being introduced to that when I was at LSU, that kind of writing. And the great thing is that I've been fortunate. I've had Esquire, GQ, Sports Illustrated forever, The Washington Post magazine, The New York Times magazine. I did a piece for them, their Play magazine, which was their sports publication. But I've had a lot of opportunities to write for all these different publications. And, it's just me out there. You go out there and they give you an assignment and you work on it, and it's really yours. And you write it, and all of a sudden it appears and 20 million people read it. It's amazing to me.
Well, it's something that not many people can do well, but you do it well, and you're in demand. And the world has changed for people like you. I would imagine in the old days you could make a living just writing.
Yeah, things were better. I made a lot of money writing magazine articles. I could make enough just by writing 3 or 4 or 5 a year to coast the rest of the year and work on my fiction. But the money's not there like it used to be. I mean, there was a time when I was getting a lot of money. And plus there were other things, they would publish overseas and I get a little bit of money. Several of them were optioned by movie companies, so I got money that way. Now some of these magazines want to keep that that option, the movie option. And so it's harder to make a living at it. The web's great. I love the internet, but it's killed our business in a lot of ways.
Well, you've written some spectacular fiction through the years, starting, as you said, with Tupelo Nights 26 years ago now. And
that's hard to believe.
Yeah,
gosh.
But it's impossible to read that book and not appreciate that there's a whole lot going on in your heart, soul, and mind.
I it's hard for me to pick up that book and read it today. I try not to. You've been to my home, and you don't see my books out. I don't put them out there, and I don't read them. But every now and then I'll be forced to have a look because I'm doing a reading or something. And it seems it's young, it strives for poetry. It's very confessional. It's this young guy pouring his soul out there on the page. And I remember writing it. And I was working as a newspaper man, and I'd get up early in the morning and work on it and work on it at night. It was my life, and I pinned all these dreams to this poor book. But it did well, and it was published in 7 different languages, and it was excerpted in Esquire, and it was quite a way to start. But it's hard for me to look at it now. I mean, there were things I could not write that book today. There's no way. There were things I was trying to do that I would never attempt now. I would be embarrassed to try to write some of those scenes.
Well, I think that book was published right when you were about 30 years old.
Yeah, yeah, I was 30. I think I wrote it when I was, started writing it. You know, I was playing with the idea when I was at LSU and writing classes in the English department. I was flirting with this idea when I was studying with Warren Eyster. He was my novel instructor. And so for all those years, I kept, you know, hitting on this thing. And finally, I figured out how to tell that story. And But I was 28, I think, when I wrote it.
It's a half a lifetime ago.
Yeah, yeah, okay. It was.
And now, at the age of 56, for number 56, it's Call Me By My Name, and this is it's quite a piece of work, and it's somewhat autobiographical, but this is your first novel since you became the family man.
Yes, it is.
How did that change your writing?
It's changed, it's changed my life. First of all, it's been a dramatic. I've had a dramatic change in my life. I have a 7-year-old daughter named Hannah, and we live with her mother, my wife Kim, in Mandeville. And I wanted to write something that she could read. I think a lot of my books are heavy with these sex scenes and rough language and. Sort of characters trying to find themselves, and then I wanted to write a book about things that I remembered from my hometown and growing up, things that she will not experience, and I wanted to get it down before I got too old and forgot these stories. And but she, you know, if not for Hannah, I wouldn't have written this book. You know, I think I was a really self-absorbed, selfish. Driven guy, very ambitious guy for years, and I've been able to put on the brakes quite a bit and appreciate things a whole lot more, mm-hmm. You know.
Well, how do you write now with these two beautiful women who certainly appreciate your time? I think you might rather spend time with them, but somehow you do what you do.
Well, I get up very early in the morning, you know, I usually put in a day's work before they're up. I'll get up at 3:30, 4 in the morning and write until around 7 when I get them up. And, you know, Hannah goes to school and then I go back to work. And I'll take little cat naps to keep going. But it's hard to, it's a little hard. Sometimes it's hard to find the poetry, you know. It's hard to find that mm-hmm. thing I used to have. That's sort of gone. That's gone away. But there's something else there. In its place, and whatever that thing is, it keeps me working at it. You know, I want to leave something for them. You know, give something that they would be proud of. I'm not proud of all that I've written. I mean, I'm proud of my career and how things have gone, but there's stuff that I've written that I would probably now take back. You know, I don't think I have the courage today that I had when I was a much younger guy. I was pretty brave. I mean, I took on, as a journalist, I took on a lot of people and, you know, institutions. And even in my fiction, I wrote in a way that was probably a heck of a lot more daring than I would attempt today. But all that said, this new book, I mean, it deals with race. And that was not easy to write mm-hmm. about.
Well, your hometown of Opelousas is considered to be Mayberry by many who live there. And a guy who I went to school with, Jim Gates, who's a lawyer there, he calls it that. And in some ways it is, but like all southern towns, it was afflicted by race and racial issues then
yes,
and
was.
To some degree now. And that's depicted in all of its troubled aspects in Call Me By My Name. How difficult was it to write about this?
It was tough. It was really tough. I mean, this was an idea that I've played with for years. But it was hard to write up because, it's a tough subject. And it took me back to when I was a kid and how things were. I think by today's definition, most everybody I knew was racist, and that's sad but true. And I don't know. It was something I wanted to write about, I'm glad I got it out of here. You know, I'm glad I'm done with this thing and it's out there. I don't want to write about it again.
Well, tell us about Tater Henry.
Tater Henry is he's a black kid who integrates the white park in his hometown, and he's you know, he faces a lot of abuse for that, and he befriends the narrator Rodney and Rodney's sister Angie. He's a guy who's sort of based on a couple of kids I knew growing up. One was a guy named Daryl Toussaint, who was the first black kid to play in the South City Park in Opelousas. And he and I were teammates. And there was another guy named Miller Chavis, who was a track star at Opelousas High School. And he was the first black athlete to participate in sports at Opelousas High. My dad was instrumental in getting him there. But so I just remembered back to these guys, what they did. You know, they were very courageous, although they never would have known that. They just wanted to play ball, you know. And so I built that character around those guys.
When you were going to Opelousas High School, how many African Americans were on the football team?
There were a lot. It was we integrated, and the school was probably 60%, I'd say 60% black, 40% white. The football team was predominantly white, but it was close, you know, and there were some tremendous black athletes there and great guys, great friends. I look back on that. They were remarkably talented guys. And I got along well with everybody. I loved all my teammates, and I've always felt that they loved me too. So, you know, the thing about sports, we hear this all the time, it's the great equalizer, and it was not, when you were out there playing, it's not an issue. It just didn't matter. Mm-hmm. You're competing, you're trying to win.
Mm-hmm. Well, you came in right at the apex of the explosion of African-American athletes in collegiate football.
Yes, I did.
5 years prior to John Ed, there were no blacks on the LSU team,
right.
And by the time you were finishing in 1979, many of the best players on the team, most prominent ones, were African-American.
That's right. I think in our recruiting class, there were under 10. There might have been, I don't know, 6, 7, 8, something like that. I didn't really count, but and by the time I left, that had really changed. But they were, I don't think we dealt with those issues. I mean, you'd have to talk to the, the black athletes and what they experienced. But things went pretty smoothly. And, we all lived in Broussard Hall, and it was great.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And I'm thinking of Charles Alexander and the Soul Patrol.
You
had a bunch of athletes who were.
Charlie was a year ahead of me, and they recruited. They recruited Texas, and they brought in guys like Willie Teal and Carlos Carson, and I mean those guys were just tremendous people. The Jones boys from Baker, Leroy. I mean, they're no finer guys than those guys.
Was Tater Henry modeled after any of them?
I guess so in a way that he's like any guy I knew back then. He's more like the kids I knew in high school, you know, the kids I grew up with and went to high school with. And I don't really name the town in the book. I thought about that coming here this morning. The town's not named, but it's obviously Opelousas. But he was great. I don't think I played with a guy as talented as Tater. You know, and I wasn't the football player that Rodney is. I mean, Rodney is telling the story, but it was fun to write. I mean, once I got rolling in that mm-hmm. book, it was fun to write it.
Well, Carl Hiaasen, who's been on this show and, of course, is a fine writer in his own right, says John Ed Bradley takes us back to a not-so-distant, hate-stained chapter of America's past and shows us the hearts of those who rose up and overcame. And that's captured in Call Me By My Name, a book about football and race and a time that you and I can relate to.
Sure.
We were part of that time, and things have improved. We have a long ways to go, but it's something that John Ed knows well, and nobody writes better about anything than Mr. John.
I could name a few dozen.
Well,
but thank you, Jim.
You've got a few years to go, but I think you'll be right there with the great writers of Louisiana has produced, and we've had a few, probably one who's listening right now, in Ernest Gaines, who I think would put you in that category. In fact, you consulted with Ernest Gaines at one point, didn't you?
Yeah, I went to see him. I had an uncle, George Bradley, who was an English professor at USL. And he arranged for me to meet Ernest Gaines. It was one of the big days of my life. And Mr. Gaines couldn't have been kinder or more generous. He was wonderful to me.
He's like you. He wears his success well, and he has great humility. And I recall from your book, your dad once told you, perhaps more than once, be humble, John. Be
yes,
humble,
did.
John Ed.
Yes, he did.
Yeah. Well, thank you, John Ed Bradley.
Thank you, Jim.
Take care. We'll be back tomorrow. Until then, thanks for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.